Page 15, and maybe the people from, maybe Roberta, you can answer this. And it said that, it says, while the variation in rate among states makes it difficult to compare facilities between states, the measure remains a valuable guide between facilities within the same state. And I didn't understand that at all. So that would be very helpful if you could explain that. That's on the bottom of page 15.
15, and is that the short stay or the long stay?
That's on the short stay.
Okay, let me
just... And you don't have to answer it now, but anyway, it was something that kind of jumped out at me. So if I briefly went through sort of my voting on this, I by and large, you know, obviously, as I said, I thought it completely answered the question about opportunity for improvement, that that there's huge amounts of evidence for this particular thing. What else? Obviously, it focuses on an outcome, not a process measure. And let's see, others. Maybe it would be just easier to say that except for that one area that there are a couple not applicables, comparable or multiple data sources was felt to be not applicable. I don't disagree with that. So generally speaking, I think that this really, except for the harmonization issue, I think that this pretty completely meets the kind of criteria that you would want to see in a measure. And I did talk briefly with Lisa, but I'll let her speak for herself on this one.
Yeah, Mary Jane and I did speak about this, and I agree with really everything that she said. This is an unusual situation because we know we have a better method for doing something. We know the staging method is better. And we also have, a clearer issue that we're testing by eliminating stage one. So we are lucky that we got this one because I think it's a clear winner, so to speak. And I gave it a complete on all four criteria. And I believe Mary Jane did as well. So.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Do you want to answer some of the questions she posed before we open it up to the group?
Sure. One of your questions had to do with seasonal variation. And we did discuss that in our initial TEP, but it didn't seem like there was such substantial seasonal variation. With other measures, what we've done is actually report on the quarter and take 6 months of data. But that is certainly something that we could take back and consider.
I know that when we've been tracking pressure ulcer rates for advancing excellence, while the trend line has been going down, we do see that seasonal variation because we now have 3 years of data, and we see it there too. So.
Sure, we could certainly do that. And in regards to harmonization, I think everybody who's had to address pressure ulcers and has worked on, assessment improvement, it's an ongoing. It's almost as soon as you write something else might be happening in terms of a measure. We did look at what NQF had in regards to a paper. Coming out, and we would expect that in going forward we would attempt to harmonize with anything for NQF.
One other comment I would make is that having been working with this particular measure on advancing excellence as well as several other things, but is this has been an area that's been particularly resistant to improvement. And so while it's useful and helpful to count the numbers, we really have to start focusing on why it's not going down. There's been sort of marginal improvements, and it's improved a little bit in some places. But even in some states where it appeared to be improving, it's gone back up again. Part of that, we have also tried to look at the denominator. And if you've tracked the denominator over 3 years, the overall denominator for acuity of nursing home residents is rising. So part of the resistance to change may well be that we're seeing a different population than we had 3 years ago. And as I said, we've been tracking that. But nevertheless, it really hasn't gone down to the extent that we know it probably could go down.
Can I just ask a quick question to follow up to that? Is it related to anything like staffing mix or staffing patterns?
I don't have the answer to that. I don't know.
Okay, other There is a study, though, by Susan Horn that looked at the relationship between pressure ulcers and staffing, and there was a relationship between RN staffing, and better RN staffing is fewer pressure ulcers. Other comments from the committee or questions, issues? Really?
Okay. Did I hear stage 2 and 4? You know, why not the first stage, you know?
What about the first stage?
Yeah.
When we initially had our technical expert panel, we asked specifically about that because there's a lot in the literature in regards to whether stage 1 is really reliable, especially assessing it in darker skin patients. And also we found that, in a sense, you're sort of, for lack of a better word, dinging facilities for recognizing uh-huh. stage 1 ulcers. And also, some of the literature, like, for example, Dr. Joanne Lin, who's done research with pressure ulcers, has mentioned that you could almost look at a stage 1 as high risk. So as we brought this to the TEP and after discussion, it was thought the important thing was to focus on the stage 2 to 4 and let the stage 1 go, not in, in terms of reporting.
But, you know, as a quality measure, if you're looking at the impact and we are not making much progress unless we have some NASA technology and become weight-free, the pressure ulcers will always happen. You know, they are preventable up to a certain extent. But I think if you really think of prevention and improvement in the care overall, all stages should be included because everything starts with stage 1. And if you miss it, then it may be too late. It's just similar to what happens with falls. You know, it doesn't matter if it's minor or major. You have to have all the processes in place, you know.
Okay.
Any other comments?
I just like to add to that. I think part of the problem with stage ones is that they can be overdiagnosed. Sometimes I think there's a lot of confusion between stage one ulcers and candidal rashes and minor bruises. So I think the reliability is in question. I think this should be sufficient. If a stage one is found and it's quickly treated, they're usually pretty easily reversible if it's really a stage one. If it becomes a stage two, then it's going to be counted. And I think your quality measure is going to be a lot more accurate excluding stage ones. And I don't think including stage ones would improve the measure that much, and I think it would hurt it. So I would agree with the way the measure is written.
And just a comment, I'm not sure the question that Dr. Corin posed about state variability was addressed. I think it related to validity. And I think the point that was made in there was that there is a lot of variability from state to state, so that when you're trying to compare a facility in one state to a facility in another state, that you know, there might be some difficulty there. But that within the same state, it has high validity.
Mary Jane, has Advancing Excellence seen any variation in states?
We do. I mean, obviously, there are very high pressure ulcer states and there are very low pressure ulcer states. And some of what we're finding is that the impact of sort of a coalition of stakeholders kind of really focusing on this problem and really working on it really does seem to have an effect, but it's a very hard effect to continue and to sustain. Mm-hmm. We saw this problem in New Jersey, for example. They had sort of come together and decided that pressure ulcers was not solely a problem of a single setting. So they got the hospital people and the ER people and the ambulance people and home care people and everybody together to kind of help together solve the problem, and the numbers went down, and then the thing fell apart. Now the numbers are going up again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one of those things that you have to constantly stay on top of.
I was going to mention one thing that we saw time and time again in the literature is that it's the ongoing monitoring and surveillance and the constant sort of day in and day out and the focus, an ongoing focus, which is difficult for facilities for sure, but so important.
Okay, are we ready
One other comment to make is that we assume that it's all about pressure, but it is as much about management of skin moisture, hydration, nutrition, a number of other factors, even use of lift devices in facilities in places that are using mechanical lifts. There's less because they're not dragging people on sheets. So there are a lot of things that we really need to start to think about that could prevent these things that we are ignoring because we think it's all about pressure.
Very good point. Are we ready for a vote? Okay. This is a vote for endorsing a time-limited measure, and that it has, which means it has not been tested because it's based on the 3.0, and that it satisfies most of the evaluation criteria. I think our reviewers have essentially said it satisfies all the criteria except for that harmonization. So given that, all those in favor of supporting this as a time-limited endorsement, please raise your hand. All those no? Abstain? Great. So we'll go to the second measure, and that is for the long-stay residents, and I believe Dr. Zoritz, you are the lead on that, and you're okay? You've said everything you needed to say?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Dr. Korn has prefaced hers with many of the same remarks I would make myself. So this is percent of high-risk residents with pressure ulcers long stay defined as 100 days or greater. It's already being measured in the current set of quality measures based on MDS 2.0, but has many of the problems which I think Mary Jane mentioned, and such as addition of stage one, reverse staging, et cetera, which have now been eliminated. I think the nice thing about the MDS 3.0 is that it is consistent not with NPUAP standards and with the way that most reasonable nursing homes, are staging their ulcers and identifying them. So I do think that it's ready for prime time. The measure is, let me get to the importance. I think I don't need to say very much about, I think we would all agree that it's an extremely important measure of quality. I do want to point out the evidence for interventions is, while accumulating, and there's a fairly extensive literature on prevention and treatment of pressure ulcers, it's not completely persuasive. There are facilities that do better jobs and there are facilities that do worse jobs, but there's still plenty of studies that show that even with comprehensive programs to prevent and treat pressure ulcers, that they're not 100% preventable and they're not 100% curable. But that notwithstanding, I think we would probably all agree that there is tremendous potential based on current literature for improvement in treatment and management of pressure ulcers. The guidelines that are out there, one of the more current guidelines is AMDA's guideline, are quite extensive, and there have been guidelines for many years. They're technically clinical guidelines. I know the AMDA guideline, which is excellent, doesn't really rate the evidence that it uses for its guideline. It's based more on clinical expertise and mm-hmm. consensus than it is on the strength of evidence. But I think that if you actually look at the literature backing it up, it's fairly strong qualitatively. Scientific acceptability, therefore, I said was partial, but I think it's more positive than negative. Complete, I think, would require that there really be rigorous double-blind randomized studies that we could point to that say, yeah, this is preventable and this is treatable 100%, but we don't quite have that yet. One question I had was that the high-risk population, now this... I guess we're doing away with the percent of high risk of low risk residents because of a variety of issues. This is high risk residents, which are defined as those who are comatose, impaired in bed mobility or transfer, or suffering from malnutrition. That's been fairly well validated in MDS 2.0, but I don't know whether that has been correlated with the Braden or the Norton scales or other commonly used scales of risk. And the issue that both Kathleen and I had when we looked at this is that malnutrition is not defined in this, except to say that if it's listed as a diagnosis on the MDS, and to the best of our knowledge, it's rarely used as a definition. It's rarely listed as a diagnosis. So I don't know how good that is going to be as a an indicator of a high-risk population. I should point out also that there is an item on the MDS 3.0 asking whether a risk assessment has been done, yes or no. And that doesn't come into play at all with identifying patients at risk, which I found a little bit surprising and perhaps, well, maybe not surprising because it hasn't been tested, but that's something that probably ought to be tested going forward. Mm-hmm. So far as usability, I think we agreed that this met the criteria completely. I think this meets the standard of identification and classification of pressure ulcers. There's nothing in the MDS 3.0 that shouldn't be consistent with the way most facilities should be identifying pressure ulcers now. And feasibility, we also felt, was complete. We did have one concern that residents, and this, I think, is also true of the current system, that residents who are admitted with very large, very bad stage 4 ulcers, which may not be expected to heal within 100 days, are going to end up counted in this number. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a weakness of this. How much that's going to impact, I don't know, but that is a weakness. And I didn't see a mechanism for excluding such ulcers on admission. That's not in the exclusion criteria. All that having been said, though, let me go to my other comments. I think I pretty much covered everything. The data is strengths. We said that the data is fairly easy to collect since it's part of the usual assessment of patients. And weaknesses, MDS 3.0 hasn't been rolled out yet. It's still unclear whether there will be discrepancies in completion of the skin care items, but that's common with all of these measures that are going to be based on 3.0. Having said all that, we decided that we would recommend the measure for endorsement.
Kathleen, anything to add?
No, I think, you know, our main concern was those people that are on end-of-life hospice that come in that, you know, have come in with stage fours, and yet, you know, we're going to get dinged on that, even though there's probably nothing that we're going to do about it. And obviously, being a dietitian originally in my career, the malnutrition issue was extremely a high impact because of anemia and all of the things. And, you know, people always assume malnutrition means essentially sarcopenia, when really, you know, obesity can be malnutrition. And I think a lot of times we think of that person that's anorexic, cachectic, not the person that's a bariatric type situation, where we really need to be watching because part of them can't even find the open areas, I mean, sadly.
I'd hope in the future that there will be further study on the MDS 3.0. There are probably a number of items on the MDS 3.0 that cumulatively will give a better indication of high risk. I think this is a fairly simplistic definition of high-risk patients, but I think it's what we have now, and I would not stop the measure for that, but I do hope that in the future perhaps it can be a little bit more precise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we expand the definition.
Yeah.
The description.
Thank you for the nice overview. Any comments from the committee or questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Would you recommend that an element be added to 3.0 to actually have a risk score? Or to say whatever scaling score they're used, can, you know, is there a way to add whether the person is at high risk, scores at high risk?
Well,
would that be helpful?
Right now, there's an element, yes or no, whether a risk assessment has been done, and that's really it. I think if you took the, and I'm just doing this off the top of my head, I suspect that if you took an established, a validated risk instrument such as Braden and looked at MDS 3.0, you'd probably be able to test out some of the items to see if there were correlation. But that's just off the top of my head. That's the kind of research I would recommend going forward. But right now, would I like to see a full risk assessment on the MDS 3.0?
No, I wasn't suggesting that. Was the risk assessment done? Yes, no. What did it show? High risk?
It doesn't. It doesn't say.
No, but I'm saying,
Well, the question is, was the patient at risk or not? The question is, was the patient at risk or not? And it's not stratified as to low risk, medium risk, high risk. It's just as, are they at risk or not, is the way the question is worded, I believe.
Yeah.
I don't have the MDS in front of me.
I do.
But that,
you're correct.
Yeah, we'll let our colleague from CMS.
Well, the other issue is probably, as an administrator in a nursing home and for several years, I don't know of any nursing home that's not doing a risk assessment for pressure ulcers when they first come in, whether it's the Briggs form, something. We're doing something to say that person's at risk, and then using the overlays or air relief mattresses or whatever. I'm not a nurse, so I can't tell you all the things that nursing uses, but I know that it is done.
Okay, so your memory is intact because the item MO150 is the resident at risk of developing pressure ulcers. It's a yes or no, and the instructional guidance includes, the recommendation to determine if the resident is at risk for developing a pressure ulcer. If the medical record reveals that there's currently a stage one or greater pressure ulcer scar over bony prominence, etc., and review formal risk assessment tool, determine if the resident, what their risk score is, and review the components of the clinical assessment conducted for the evidence of pressure ulcer risk. So all that is kind of rolled into and lumped into yes or no.
Thank you, Sherry.
But I don't know how helpful that is because it's not, as I said, it's not stratified. So we're talking about high risk, and high risk is not identified in that question. It's just, are they at risk, yes or no?
As it relates to CMS, some nursing homes probably are going to have populations that are tougher. I'm really not actually interested in recommending personally a risk-adjusted rate for this, because if you know you have a patient that you need to do more for to keep them from getting a pressure ulcer, we actually would kind of hope you wouldn't say, well, they're not going to count against us anyway because we've risk-adjusted them out. If at some point we can identify who is absolutely going to get them or who has a 90% chance, I would love to say, this person's over 400 pounds or their BMI is 72 or something, and therefore we're going to throw them out of the sample. But I think risk adjustment of this measure might be risk adjusting away something we'd actually like the staffs
and
to do.
I don't think it's possible. I think there are places that have very high risk residents that don't get pressure ulcers, and even within a facility, there are high risk residents that are free of pressure ulcers and high risk residents that get them. And there are so many factors, as Mary Jane pointed out, we don't always know why the one that got him, other than, did you turn and position them? Were they on a pressure-reducing mattress? How's their nutrition, hydration? We can look at all that, but sometimes we just don't know. And I don't think the science is at the point where we can predict with any accuracy someone is definitely going to get them or someone's definitely not going to get them.
I remember at the end of our agenda tomorrow, there's a place where we can talk about recommendations for future research, so we would want to hold that thought. Any other comments?
I think those comments, you know, those questions, are they at risk, or just to be stop and point that you should be care planning at that point. I don't think it's to pull it all together. It's just a pointer that you need to stop as a clinician and look deeper. So I think that's what the MDS-3 is intending on those questions. So,
Lisa?
Yeah, I was just wondering, what is the rationale for limiting this to high-risk residents only?
Well, initially there were two reported measures, both the high and the low risk. And when we addressed it with the TEP, the low risk, the mean was 2.3%. I think it was based on 2007 data. And the standard deviation was 2.8%. At the 50th percentile, it was like 1.9% was the triggering rate. And for facilities without that had a 0%, it was like about 40%. So they,
if you were to translate that into a different type of speak, what would you be
sure,
saying?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Essentially, in regards to the reportability of the measure, mm-hmm. and how usable it would be for low-risk patients, it was, you know, really in terms of measurement, not enough facilities could even report their low risk. Gotcha. So henceforth, the focus on the high-risk patients.
Okay. Thank you.
That's not to mention, I believe it will still remain a sentinel event if a low-risk patient gets a pressure ulcer. So the facilities aren't off the hook altogether just because the measure has gone away.
But not publicly reported.
Is the group ready for a vote? Okay. Again, I'd remind you, first of all, our two reviewers have indicated complete on all four criteria. Partial on scientific acceptability, which is one of the reasons it's recommended for time-limited endorsement. And so we would be voting on time-limited endorsement for long-stay pressure ulcers in a long-stay population. All those in favor, please raise your hand. No, raise your hand. Abstain. Okay, we have two. Yay. Supposed to take a break, but I think we did that. So we're going to be moving on to the immunization measures.
Thank you.
And just let me get my act together here. So that would be another representative from CMS. And our first one is 1410. Percent of residents who were assessed and given seasonal influenza vaccination during the flu season. This is for short stay. Are you going to speak to all of the immunization?
Well, actually, let's just do the influenza.
Oh, okay.
Short and long stay together.
Okay.
Then we'll do pneumococcal short and long stay together. Some of the timing issues may be the same, but I think some of the other stuff is different. So.
Yeah, some of my comments will be very similar, but I will begin with the influenza vaccines. So I'm Shula Bernard from RTI. Good afternoon. The two influenza vaccine, the first one is for short stay, the second one's for long stay, and I think short stay and long stay has been defined extensively all throughout the day, so I won't belabor that. In deference to the time and Dr. Gifford's request that we not go over and over about the high impact, suffice it to say that frail elders are particularly vulnerable to complications of influenza. And according to CDC, more than 200,000 people in the United States each year are hospitalized as a result of complications. And among the adults 65 and older, about 72% were vaccinated during the 2006-2007 influenza season, which is below the Healthy People 2010 target of 90% for this age group. The MDS 2.0 data used to publicly report on influenza vaccination quality measure shows that the first quarter of 2007 statewide averages for the short stay population ranged from 57% to 85%, with a 73% national average. So there is variability in performance on this measure. And the nursing home compared, the national average for the percent of short stay residents given the influenza vaccine has increased to 82%. Among the long stay population, the range is from 76% to 96%. So there is a difference between the short stay and the long stay proportions, which would is an argument for us having two different measures, one for the each population. And also, the current information of the nursing home compare shows the national average for the percent of long stay residents given the influenza vaccine increasing to 90%. So the public reporting of this measure, whether it's causal or not, has been associated with an increase in the adherence to vaccination. What I'd like to emphasize about this is that this measure is essentially unchanged from the MDS 2.0 going to the 3.0 with an exception, and the exception is that there are additions to the numerator and denominator that were done in order to harmonize the measure to the NQF vaccine measure. So as a result, the 3.0 will be harmonized with the NQF. So this is a previously endorsed measure that we think as a result of going to the 3.0 will make it more consistent with the NQF measure. The other areas of importance to consideration for this panel is that the usability, these measures have a history of being used, and obviously some of the percentages that I quoted to you showed some association with an increase in vaccination, perhaps as a result of the measure and the reporting of the measure. The feasibility, data for the measure have been collected and will continue to be collected in the same manner in the MDS 2.0 and MDS 3.0. So I will now leave you to discussion. And
just one point of clarification. On the numerator component, the standard specifications indicate that those are supposed to be computed and reported separately. And it looks as if, at least the way this is written up, that it's all combined into one total numerator.
So combined for the
different the standard specifications are that you report on those who actually received the vaccine, those who were offered and declined, and those who had medical contraindications. But the way it looks in the way you've written up the specifications is that you're adding those all up to get one rate, and that is not consistent with
the NQF. Yes. Right. So thank you. We will need to clarify that to indicate that what the harmonization is to be consistent with the NQF.
Right. So that is still going to be possible. I just want to make sure, because at the prior nursing home measure actually did kind of lay it out that way. So
what we have before us in writing is not what you're going to propose then?
No. Let me just revisit that a second while we look at, let me look at the definition with you and just see what your question is.
Okay. So if we look at the numerator statement.
That's in writing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
That's not harmonized with the NQF. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So the elements are, so those who received during the most recent, either the facility or outside the facility, the number who were offered and declined, and the number who were ineligible. The only distinction is that in the standard specifications, we want those each of those computed and reported separately.
So that one is a separate measure, two mm-hmm. is a separate measure, and three is a separate measure, all with the same denominator?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Which I think is a clarification, not a change.
It's like the staffing like the measure. The staffing measure.
Mm-hmm. The commas did not mean. Yeah. So.
That is the way we would need to clarify that, but it is consistent with the NQF. So if the commas are not in
right,
the right
it's
place,
just
they will
what
be.
We just yeah. Let me just give you a little history about
okay.
it. There was a lot of discussion. You know, we had lots of different immunization measures and a lot of different ways that people handled patient refusal. Some were excluding it from the denominator. Some were counting it in the numerator. And the steering committee on that project said that we need to be very transparent about how these mm-hmm. are. And ultimately, the main thing that we're most interested in are those who are actually getting vaccinated. And so in order to kind of address all of the issues and make, you know, so this was a harmonization and a compromise kind of thing, but mm-hmm. to actually have those all in the numerator, but separate components so
yes.
that you could very clearly see that, you know, facilities differ on actual vaccination rates. So you could actually
yes,
see
yes, and 2%
things.
A decline, X
right.
percent, a
right.
yes. And that's the way this is constructed.
Just a question.
Is the in the NQF specification that we want to harmonize, or that I believe CMS wants to harmonize mm-hmm. to, is there also a total of 1 plus 2 plus 3, the overall? Okay, so it's not 1 and 2 and 3 and the sum. It's just 1 and 2 and 3 with the exclusions and definitions tied tightly to the NQF definition that already exists.
Right.
Okay.
And as a separate ratio relative to the denominator, which is everyone in the facility, one denominator.
So I have a question about the NQF consensus recommendations. I mean, it said, I know it says you need the three, but is it wrong to add them up? Because in the end, you really want to know. I mean, first of all, I always want to shine a light on refusals because we looked at this in the VA, and if you don't, the number of refusals go up and they get hidden when they're subtracted from the denominator. So I think it's really important to have those three. But for looking at the website and understanding this for the public, I think it's very helpful to have, you know, what proportion of the time was the right thing done, whether that's appropriately not giving it or appropriately giving it. So are you, like, not allowed to report it?
The standard specifications actually do say computed and reported separately and not to be totaled. Mm-hmm. Because once you total, you start obscuring those things. And the discussion at the steering committee for that project was that that whole category of patient refusal is a very fuzzy area, and practices around that are quite fuzzy, and what's counted as a refusal versus, mm-hmm. you know. So anyway, they really felt pretty strongly that they needed to be computed and reported separately. This gets into the area of what control NQF has over once measures get out there, but that is how the specifications mm-hmm. are, that's the recommendation. And if you can't do all of those because, for example, claims-based measures don't know the refusal, then the main thing is that element of patient vaccination actually is consistent. So at least you can report that component. Mm-hmm. That was the thinking of that committee.
Bruce, you're the primary reviewer on this, so would you like to proceed?
We gave the measure, I gave the measure all completes. And I had just a couple of remarks. One was, by the way, I would modify it with the proviso that was just described, that it actually be reported in a way that is in harmony with existing NQF measures, but I think that's a clarification, not a change. So that's sort of for the record. Interestingly, Diana said something that I'm going to say here. In my notes, I said there's an opportunity for gaming. Why exclude the case if it's blank? I like what we concluded before, which is in the absence of any underlying overriding reason, rewarding someone for leaving an information cell blank seems to me counterproductive. And so I would make, how in whatever mechanism that the co-chairs think is reasonable, I would have added that proviso.
Don't the guidelines say that?
It's not part of the standard specifications.
In this, it says blank.
Right.
It gets excluded.
Understand. I'm just saying that the NQF.
Right, and I think where there's not a reason to do that, I had the same note. I do have one question, having said so, all complete, I like the measure. This is a process measure that approaches being an outcomes measure just because of the strength of the science. I'm not one to say that often. But it looks to me like the measure is going to be based on deciles or quartiles as opposed to some sort of significance testing. In my world, sometimes that leads to highlighting differences or distinctions without a difference. That's why we never rank hospitals, because hospital number 9 is never actually statistically significantly better than hospital number 10. And so we always compare to the mean. So I don't know if, as the measures developer, you could talk to why you explicitly sort of excluded the notion of significance testing. That's my report.
Patricia, did you have anything to also add?
No, I don't think so. I agree.
Oh, I'm sorry. I agree with that. Pretty much what he verbalized about that.
There, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, just a comment, Bill Kubat, and maybe Bruce or others can, help me with this one. I'm supportive of it as well. But it always struck me, even when it came around the first time, and what I see in the documentation seems to bear this out. They talk about guarded validity. It's almost as much more of a public health interest measure than it is a quality improvement measure. It's always been a struggle for, in terms of facilities and for the public, the extent to which the measure differentiates good and poor facilities, good and poor care processes, and so forth. And how that reflects in terms of the scientific methodology and the usefulness. Because one of the things that we do also with the usefulness is, well, it's already out there. I mean, it's already on the Compare website now, and CMS wants us to use it for quality improvement. So therefore, it's useful. Well, I mean, it's grandfathered.
Because I remember seeing guarded validity too, and I don't remember what my notes say. Do you have it in front of you by any chance where it is, or can you do a quick word search on guarded?
Because yeah. It's on page 11.
Guarded was referencing a limited piece.
It's the University of Colorado consistently gave guarded for a lot of these immunizations, which was a problem for me. I couldn't understand what they meant by that. Guarded validity. So
it's in 2B. Yeah. 2B.
Or not 2B. That is the question.
2C3.
It's
influenza measure for short stay residents received a rate of guarded for validity testing.
Yeah. Right. I had it. The word guarded is circled.
Yep.
It had a level of statistical significance that was like borderline, and so they didn't want to go so far as to say always. Was within the area where it was considered a strong
measure. Yeah.
But that's why it was identified as guarded.
What metric are they using? like, it's not U.S. Preventive Task Force. I mean, somehow they have guarded in quotes, so it's some metric of...
They had tested the...
it's their own metric. No, I'm just saying, what metric? Do they use their own metric?
They didn't use the U.S. Preventive Task Force.
They just created their own rating metric. Guarded is their own rating metric.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just, you know...
Do we know what that metric range is?
Yep.
Guarded is guarded at the bottom, is at the top, is
be sure
middle?
You're using the microphone.
Can you guys use the microphone?
The expectation was
the microphone.
Well, why? And while she's getting to the microphone, just from a simplistic standpoint, the issue of the question to me is, what is this supposed to mean, or provide? What kind of useful information is it to provide the consumer that helps to differentiate? That's the whole question, and not to say that it doesn't, but it, when I see the word guarded and so forth, public health interest is legitimate, but it's different than.
I just want to before we get attached to this word, it's in quotes. Colorado made up some metric like the U.S. preventive grading of A, B, C, D. I just don't know what guarded is. Guarded could be like the second from the top and the best thing, or it could be the bottom. It could be the worst thing. I just want to know what Colorado says for guarded before we. Jump all over guarded. We're jumping over a word. We're interpreting a word that's in quotes, and I just wonder what Colorado's metric is. That's all.
And what aspects of validity and reliability were guarded, because it's not the whole topic.
I mean, if it's guarded because it was 0.049... They want to be under 0.05, then who cares? If it's because it was 0.9.
The issue was the variability across the country. So in the analysis they did of the influenza immunization measure for short stay residents, the measure was well correlated with other immunization QMs, so they were looking at its how highly correlated it was to other acceptable immunization QMs, but it was not related to any other measure of nursing home quality. In addition, the measure showed substantial geographic variation, which may suggest that the performance was influenced by factors other than facility quality. So they weren't ready to go out and say, yes, definitely, this is a good measure. But it did appear to suggest that it was a good measure.
And since we're doing these two together, I assume that it's the same for the long stay, right? Because it has the same guarded.
This was only for does because it says for short stay patients.
For the long stay, it says the same thing, guarded.
So it sounds like this is the first measure that actually someone tested to see whether it was correlated with quality.
Yes,
of all the measures we've done.
Or at least correlated with the other measures.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah,
or
that's what I mean. So it's some sort of content. It's some sort of criterion validity test that no one else has actually even done on any of the measures we've talked about so far.
Or correlated with other nursing home measures. There was a time when the availability of the vaccine was in short supply, and so facilities may have tried to get the vaccine but couldn't get the full. Amount of vaccine. So that's, I think, what he's referring to here is that there may be other external factors to specific facility performance that may impact on the proportion of residents receiving the vaccine that may not have to do necessarily with quality.
And I'll just make a comment about this because the Measure Testing Task Force is addressing some of the, you know, and we haven't given real explicit direction on what reliability and validity testing. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, as David said, the fact that they actually have addressed this and, you know, the correlations with other quality measures is one way of looking at it. The fact that this is strongly related to outcomes, you know, gives it quite a bit of face validity. Mm-hmm. The reliability statistics seem to be quite high, so I'm not sure why they even mentioned guarded in relation to reliability. But
well, the Kappa statistics for actual being able to measure this that was done by Saliba and Buchanan were 0.989.
Right.
So. Oh, that's reliability.
That's reliability.
Sorry.
That's right. That's what I meant. The reliability, yeah. You know, the comment about guarded is made for both, but I.
Well,
the
comment about guarded, I think he's referring more to validity than than the reliability. But.
Can I raise a question about the numerator as it pertains to usability? My question is, I completely understand why each of those three items need to be part of the numerator. But what I'm wondering is numbers 2 and 3, if we're really trying to get at immunity and protection from infection, what value do numbers 2 and 3 have on their own in terms of the way we report those to the public? Are those going to have any meaning to people?
Well, I'll answer for the committee that came up with these. Again, it's to put things in context. They really are most interested in the vaccination rate, and should someone decide to report only that component, I don't think anyone would have a complaint. But they really wanted to have those other elements done in a standardized way and to be very transparent. So their idea was that it provides, you know, for those that are assessing immunization status and offering, that is appropriate care. Mm-hmm. And it's a different category than actually receiving vaccination. And they thought it provides useful information for people to look at, you know, where are the differences and what that relates to. But I understand your point, and all I can say is that, you know, they're most interested in the actual vaccination rate, but thought those other two components provided more useful information.
You know, the same issue, I'm a reviewer on the long stay, and one of my recommendations to CMS is that they explore this. I mean, I think they need to explore what's the best way to display and explain these data to the public. I think that they're very useful to a facility to look at themselves in comparison to everyone else. I mean, you know, if their proportion of refusals is much higher than everyone else, everyone should be pointing their finger. I personally think everyone should be pointing their finger at them. But I agree with you. I mean, I think that should be something that we recommend to CMS, is that they look into that.
Yeah, I think so, too, because that tells you something entirely different. When I looked at the numerator, my guess was they were really trying to find out about assessment of the condition as opposed to if you have an immunization or not. But when I looked at the sample for the 3.0 MDS, it does pull that out, and you could pull that number out if you wanted to. So that made me happy, and I think this other makes them happy. But I think that you're right, though, because this information can be useful for so many other things aside from just getting the immunization, as far as education, as far as family members. I know in long-term care facilities we sometimes include the families because of their resident family programs and immunize family members as well as residents.
Darlene Thompson. Yeah, I agree. I think all three need to be reflected so that when somebody looks at that, they're not just looking at the number that was given, because without knowing the other two. The only suggestion I have to the individual developer is that under 2A2, where it talks about the numerator time frame, with the MDS 3.0, right now it's still that October 1st through June 30th. However, CMS has indicated that they've left that open because CDC may change the time frame of the influenza. So they probably want to make sure that they keep that a little bit more flexible. They have now removed that as a hard stop and a skip pattern in the MDS 3.0. So there is a slight indication that there might be some errors in data coming in, because it – right now it's a hard stop. You can't answer it if you're outside those boundaries. Now they will, unless the people have software that will automatically turn it on and off depending upon what that influenza season is defined by CDC.
And the standard specifications actually say it could be given prior to October 1 if the supply is available. So the in the measure that was, you know, the specifications that were developed by this committee was to acknowledge that patients may have received it prior to October 1, and that would count and be very appropriate.
However, there's some concern about giving elderly the vaccine too soon because of how long their immunization would cover them through the flu season.
Yeah, CDC changed that recommendation this year. Mm-hmm. Their experts did. I mean, that's why we gave it. We gave out the vaccine in August and September to the elderly. The seasonal this year, they said that was a theoretical thing that everyone sort of talked about, and actually when it push came to shove, they said, nope, the evidence doesn't support it.
I think part of that is that the it takes a couple weeks to build the immunity. And, of course, with all that was going on in the past year with the H1N1 and so forth, they felt getting that seasonal immunity in quickly would help. And I think that it lasts about a year or so. Plus, the next year's strains are going to be different from this year's strains. So.
Well, this year they were dealing with two different vaccine issues.
DDU did the long-term. Do you want to add is anything different to the long-term?
Yeah, I would say there's one thing, and it's the issue that I brought up before.
Your microphone.
The denominator potentially includes people who could be there short of less than 100 days. So that just has to be fixed. The second and third parts of the denominator, which are so painful to go into, I will not go into any detail, but of people who, you know, were discharged during the flu season but came in before the flu season and the other way around. Because you're dealing with admission and discharge, it could be less than 100 days. So that 100-day specification should be in the denominators. It has the same problem that you mentioned, Bruce, about that should be fixed, about people who have data missing should be in the denominator and not in the numerator.
Would they be captured in the short stay, or are you concerned they'll fall through the cracks completely?
If all you have to do to eliminate all your bad patients is leave a field blank, then I know what I will figure out how to do.
Okay.
So what it's on the table, summarizing it, would be a motion to approve the measure with modification. This is not a time-limited measure.
Can I ask one clarification? Because I didn't read the short-term measure. I mean, when you said falling through the cracks, we just want to make sure that everybody's covered. So, as opposed to being covered twice. So, I mean, it has to be defined as anyone less than 100 days needs to be in that short stay.
That's right.
That too.
That's right. And that's why it's okay. Defined.
The prior steering committee also, and maybe you could address this, asked why there needs to be two measures. Because the recommendations for immunization don't vary depending on whether you're short stay or long stay.
Part of it is that you're dealing with two distinct populations within a nursing facility. There is variability in the percent that are being vaccinated in those two populations, as I indicated earlier. And so you're bringing together performance on two populations and averaging them. And in this way, you can understand whether or not the problem is that the people who are coming in during the flu season or something may not be assessed adequately versus the long stayers in a facility.
So the measure that we most recently endorsed was one measure, but could be stratified by those populations. I mean, it ends up to be the same difference.
It's the same difference, yes. Whether you call it one measure stratified or one measure for short stay and another for long stay.
Bob? I can also tell you that based on my experience, the process to vaccinate long-term residents versus short-term residents tends to be different. Long-term residents tend to be vaccinated within a very short time on a regular schedule every year. Short-term residents really requires a different mindset to make sure that there's a standing order or an order written and that it's done on a regular basis. And so it can fluctuate over the flu season, whereas the long-term residents, there really should be no fluctuation. So I think it would be problematic to try to keep them together.
All right, so if I can summarize the discussion, that what's thrown out in the pit would be a vote on accepting the measure with three minor modifications. One would be that the long-term, short-term definition be modified to make sure it captures everyone and there's no loophole in the 100-day. Number two would be that the and maybe this is more guidance actually to CMS on the MDS, which is the ability to expand or contract the time frame depending on what the public health recommendations are for administering the seasonal influenza. Because right now it says October, but as we saw last year, we all said give it earlier. And the last would be looking at that if the data is missing, that it be counted as not being administered.
I would say there's one more that okay. I think it might help CMS to have officially added, and that's that the usability to the public of how you portray these measures needs to be explored.
So in public reporting.
Helen, within NQF, we don't have conditions or statements on how the measures can be used, do we? Because it's not just a CMS.
Oh, no, I'm just saying it's to the developers.
Yeah, it's to the developers. I mean, it's some guidance, but I don't think it's a condition, on the measure. I think it's in the notes and everything else. But I would say, no, it's not a condition for voting because the whole science about how you compare and is, yes, I know. I know, I know where you're trying to go. I'd love to go there, too, but
but if we include it in the recommendation.
It's beyond our scope. So I'd say accept with minor modifications that I just listed, missing data, flexibility in time frame, and the make sure the denominator for time frame. That's right. And harmonizing it with NQF standards for reporting the measure, the three numerators. Thank you. Anyone else like to add conditions on while we're at it?
Did you keep in there the second time the thing about unless there's some reason not to, that blank fields?
Blank fields. Yeah, missing data
should not be excluded.
Yeah, correct.
They should be a problem.
Blank fields, missing data. Time frame expanded beyond October, the denominator definition short, long term, and the harmonization with NQF. Those are the four conditions, except with those four conditions. Okay? All in favor? All opposed? Abstaining? Beautiful.
And we just voted on two?
We voted on both of them together. Knocked off two at once.
Okay.
Pneumococcal, short and long term.
Pneumococcal, the proposed measure is, again, the same as the MDS 2.0 with the addition of harmonization with the NQF pneumococcal vaccine measure. So using the MDS 3.0, the numerator, and hopefully it's correct this time, measures the number of short-stay residents whose pneumococcal vaccine is up to date or who were offered but declined the vaccine or who were ineligible because of medical contraindications. It's the same issue of separating it. Otherwise, it is the same measure as the current endorsed measure from the MDS 2.0.
Okay, Patricia, I believe you were the main reviewer on that.
Right. I'm the primary reviewer. Dr. Dickert and Dr. Schumacher
are secondary. And some of the same issues with the numerator, but I'm just not going to go into that because we'll apply the same to that. I went through this, and I felt that it was complete for everything, except I had some questions about the scientific accessibility or acceptability, and but we've kind of gone over that because some of the same things that occurred, I went over the flu too, and some of the same things that are in the influenza are in the pneumococcal with the guarded and so forth. Plus, I feel like a lot of this information was from 2006 and so forth, and we've come a long way since then. In this respect, there's been more education, more promotion of immunizations, and so I think, and plus now we're seeing hospitals and the other healthcare systems all becoming aware and participating. And so that's going to me, create a different environment now than existed in 2006. I don't know whether you feel that way, but I think the 3.0 is probably going to reflect all that.
Among the short stay or?
I think for both.
Uh-huh.
I think for both. Okay. People are more aware now, and they're probably documenting better. I know in hospitals now this is included in their admission, standardized admission orders for pneumococcal and for influenza. And I think there was a harmonized approach, as much as I can understand how that worked. I think that that's been done. I think the only weakness that I was a little concerned about was the statement on the getting the second vaccination. In other words, if the person did not meet the criteria coming in, if they were under 65 or whatever, that was not addressed. And I'm trying to remember where I underlined that NQF said that they did not want to pursue that. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to try and find the page for you.
This was an issue of, you know, how easily you could implement that into a quality measure. So, you know, certainly if there's some way that it can be done, would be fine. But in those standard specifications, the committee at that time said, you know, that's great. We recognize that that's the guideline. But how would you actually operationalize that in a measure for which we have data across a lot of different settings? But that's from that committee.
But the expectation would be that that would be pursued by the facility still, right?
Of the need
for the second vaccine.
Because
I think that's an important issue with some people.
I don't believe that that's necessarily addressed by this measure. But it'll be something that we'll take a look at.
I think it should be looked at in light of the fact that, pneumococcal pneumonia is responsible for so many deaths and illnesses. And now there's a resistant pneumococcal out there, so that you want to make sure people are fully immunized against this. So I think that should be looked at. And, of course, importance, I think it's very important. I'm a very big proponent of immunizations. It decreases the pneumococcal pneumonia. It decreases severity of pneumonia. It decreases hospitalizations. And it contributes to the large population immunizations. And it decreases missed opportunities for giving vaccination. The scientific acceptability, I just told you that my only problems were with some of that validity and analytic testing. I wasn't quite sure I understood how they did it, and I wonder about the quality of the information they had at that time to work with. And the usability, I think, is wonderful because you can use this in facilities for educational purposes and to decrease outbreaks and help with investigations like that. And I think it can be understood by consumers, but I agree with Diana. I think there has to be a way to make it palatable to consumers so they understand what the importance is and why they should know about that if they're taking someone to a facility. And the feasibility, I think that you can implement this easily and get the information you need easily.
So I was the secondary reviewer on the pneumococcal vaccination for short stay. And there was one piece that I picked up on that I thought was a little bit weaker, although overall I thought, you know, it was a good measure that met all the criteria. And that was around susceptibility to inaccuracies. And there were some comments here that the reliability may be stronger for the chronic care measure than the acute care measure, that there was 13% of the time the current pneumococcal immunization measure was assessed differently by different assessors. So I think there were some issues there with accuracy on the short-term vaccination. I don't know if anyone has any comments on that.
Alice Bell, if I just might ask, because in the description of the measure it speaks to measuring up-to-date status, which would address the second vaccination, as well as particularly with short-stay residents, those who might have gotten the vaccine before they were admitted to the center, so who are up-to-date but don't have the vaccine administered in the center. So is the measure up-to-date status, or is it administration in the facility?
It is not administration of the facility. It is up to date because they are assessing. I think the key term here is assessing the residents for the need for the vaccine. And if there is a need for the vaccine, then they provide the vaccine. But in the among the short stay or residents, there is, and if especially if they're coming from an acute care setting, there is a high likelihood that they would have had the. The vaccine, especially when you're talking about the pneumococcal vaccine, in the acute care setting. So obviously, you can't expect the nursing facility to provide a vaccine for someone who's already. But it's the assessment, and if there's a determination of need, be it because they've exceeded the time since the prior one, or because they've never had one, that's part of the assessment of what the residents need. So I'm
Thank
sorry
you.
If I misspoke earlier.
So in this particular data item, it probably already it takes into account the need for a second vaccine
yes,
as well.
Yes, and I'm sorry I misspoke before because it does. It's the assessment that that the expectation is that the resident will be assessed, and if there is a need, the resident has been given the vaccine.
Darlene Thompson, the facilities are going to follow a determine if the resident's vaccine is up-to-date based on that definition in the REI manual is what does up-to-date mean. So I think it's really important that when CMS, they're continuing to refine their manual. They had an excellent seminar last week on the MDS 3.0, that they make that clear. And also, not all short-stay patients coming from a hospital to a nursing center are even going to be eligible to get the pneumococcal vaccine because it's not something you give to everybody
That's
just
right.
because. So, and also in the manual, it needs to say that if the resident, we get 19-year-old, 20-year-old kids coming into our facility, so would they be considered not eligible because it's a medical contradiction, or no, because they're not old enough to get it, but no would make it sound like they should have had it when they shouldn't have. So there's really, that falls into that not offered. So I think as long as the manual is clear as to what to do in those instances, that would be helpful in making sure that this measure is clear as well.
Okay, that's a good point. You're talking about refining the eligibility determination.
And I think you brought up 3.0. So it does say in here that there's more clarity around this in 3.0. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that this one, at least on the short stay, I didn't look at long stay, but short stay is a time limited. So is that because the it's changed with 3.0 from 2.0? In terms of how the questions are asked. It says the changes are minor.
They're minor changes to the questions to clarify the way that they're being asked. And I don't have the copy of the MDS 3.0 here. But
the changes are more on the influenza one. There are more selections on when it's not offered. I don't really see anything big in the pneumococcal one.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be in the definitions. That'll be in the manual. Mm-hmm.
So,
form itself.
So why is this one marked as time limited?
Yeah, I was going to suggest we override the vendors potentially, depending on how the dialogue goes.
I was waiting to see how the dialogue goes, but yeah, it's a reasonable request. I was the secondary review on the long-term one. I'd say the only thing I would add, and I didn't pick it up on it, but it was a good pickup, which is the issue of falling through the cracks that we talked about mm-hmm. before. The only other thing there was that I'd say that there really isn't, they didn't really present any other than content validity. They didn't do any criterion or construct validity type testing on the measure out there. But then most of the stuff we've had hasn't had that out there as a quality measure overall. But it really, there's a lot of good validity testing on the link between the two. So I wasn't too concerned about that. And to your question, it's all residents, because pretty much anyone's going to go into a nursing home probably meets the definition of needing to get the pneumococcal vaccine. And if they don't, you know, there's still a benefit from getting the vaccine anyway. So it's so few people, it's probably not worth the squeeze to try to get exclude them out of the measure.
To the co-chairs, as we try and harmonize, would it be worth when we – because I think all of the one – two, three issues that we dealt with in the last one, do they not apply here, Karen? You know, the one, two, three
yes,
issues?
Yes, yes.
So you're going to rewrite them essentially identical so that the clarity that it's Category 1 and Category 2 and Category 3 for three different measures with, I believe, the same denominator. Mm-hmm. In other words, whatever you do on the other one, I think you cut and paste on this one, right?
Yeah.
There's no reason not to have exactly the same. Okay.
And we will run it by Karen to make sure that it harmonizes with the NQF, which is the intent of this.
So on the table then would be to approve the measure with conditions. The vendor asked for time limited. I guess before we do that, why were you asking for time limited on not just ask like for influenza, that we just go with this measure?
We hadn't had the MDS 3.0.
Typo?
Typo. Yeah, typo.
Good answer. Typo.
Yeah.
Okay,
I mean,
so the group.
Absolutely a typo.
Stop talking. Stop talking. The typo. So the group is. The on the table is to approve the measure with three minor conditions of modification, harmonize with NQF standards for the numerator definition, close the loophole for the short-term, long-term stay, and I'm going to add in, Bruce, you can bring up the same thing with treating blanks as not given. Mm-hmm. The time frame, we don't have to do that, but that would be it. So that's those three conditions. Approve with those three minor modifications. All in favor? All opposed? Any abstaining? Wonderful. We could. You would like to do falls, or would you like a 10-minute break?
We are
10 minutes behind schedule. We're supposed to have a break at 3:15, and it's 3:30. So we're pretty darn close. You guys want to keep going? We'll do the falls, and then we'll do a break? Okay. Yes. That was for both 16 and 17, yes. Knocked off two again. Okay. Who from RTI is doing falls?
Okay.
What are we doing? Let me ask the primary. We've talked about. Are any of these that are under the fall measures section? So that's why I called it. It's the falls measures section. Are any of these that need to be bundled together, like we're going to vote or group them together, like we just had the dialogue here, or should we sort of break them all out?
The two I'm primary on, number 8 and number 5, they can be lumped together and voted together.
Number 8 and number 5?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, but they're two separate organizations.
They're two different organizations. Oh, so we got to do them separate. Yeah, yeah. We have to pick which baby we like better. Okay.
Both have.
There's three organizations. We don't like the third. We're just going to pick between two. Okay. RTI, you want to start with which you pick? Which one do you want to go first here?
How about Falls with Major Injury?
Falls with Major Injury.
Hello again, everybody.
Number what?
Falls with Major Injury is NH-008.
Number eight.
Number eight. Okay. This is a new measure that we are proposing. And the purpose of the measure, it's intended to help to monitor the falls, rate of falls with major injury. And that consists of either bone fracture, joint dislocation, close head injuries with altered consciousness, or subdural hematomas among long-stay residents occurring in nursing facilities. It's estimated that 75% of nursing facility residents fall at least once a year at twice the rate of their community counterparts. Saliba and Buchanan tested the proposed MDS 3.0 items, assessing the prevalence of any falls or falls with major injury. And basically, the study sample included over 4,500 residents. And they found that during this six-month data collection period, approximately 24% of patients reported at least one fall since the prior assessment. And among